You're listening to Lawyers, Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley. And time is 13 minutes past 12. And being the second Wednesday of the month, we've got with us Hutchison Legal, and we've got the big chief today, Grant and Ilaria. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here. I didn't realise I was that big.
Over to you. You're going to say, you've got to say something.
I was just going to leave you hanging after calling me big.
Now, we had some people in last month, as we always do. We had some question. The question was, there's been a few citizens arrest. Now, there was a twofold to the question that the listener wanted to know. First of all, what rights do you have, or are you protected at all if you're doing a citizen's arrest and the person happens to get hurt? And the second one is, if you accidentally have reason to believe this person was the offender, but it turns out they weren't, and they get hurt, they didn't want to be arrested in the first place, and you had no right to arrest them, but you didn't know that, and B, what, they get hurt. So can we tell us what you found out?
Most people don't want to be arrested, generally.
I would have thought no one wanted to be arrested.
But, Ilaria, what would happen, let's say, so somebody calls out, thief, he's taken my purse, and then somebody jumps on another person carrying a purse, maybe another lady, and or otherwise, but you pick the wrong person. What happens there?
Well, you would first have to argue that that arrest or the citizen's arrest, because you can arrest someone if they're committing an offence, but it needs to be reasonable. So you've got to have a reasonable mind, or you've got to think about it reasonably. Is it reasonable to go and arrest this person? If it turns out to be the wrong person, well, you're still protected as long as that arrest or that assumption was reasonable. If it was unreasonable, then you're liable for criminal charges or civil penalties or both.
Well, what would happen, though, and that's fine if you arrest them and they are the crook. What happens if they're not a crook? You've made a mistake, but you honestly believe they were, but they got hurt during that.
Well, it depends on the nature that manner that caused the injury. So if you've used excessive force, then you're obviously liable to some charges for assault or reckless cause injury. You obviously didn't have the intention to cause the injury, but the injury occurred as a result of, well, what would seem to be a lawful arrest. That would consider reckless cause injury, but it would of course be up to the police as to whether they decide to file charges with the court or not. Police have the discretion as to whether they want to charge someone, and it depends on individual circumstances as to whether they would.
All right, so the police have got that, but then, all right, the police come along and they say, oh no, I think you really did it with right intention. But the person says, well, hang on, I've been injured now, I'm going to sue you.
They can pursue that course. So on the balance of probabilities, the deciding fact finder would have to decide, well, whether it was that injury was a cause of that incident or not. And of course, they'd have to take into other factors, which is obviously beyond my scope, given that I'm a criminal lawyer.
Yep.
It would have to go to a civil litigator. And you'd probably have to seek advice in that area. But if criminal charges were laid and there was a conviction as a result, there are other avenues in which that person can obtain compensation. For example, the victim can ask, say, for example, at Hutchison Legal or its sister firm at Your Lawyer, they can ask them to contact the person that filed the charges, get them to restrain the offender's assets and seek compensation under the Sentencing Act.
So really, you've got to be very... If you're going to do a citizen's arrest, you really need to be, A, sure that the person's done it, and secondly, that you don't injure them. Is that what's coming out of
this?
Well,
the tip is to always call the police. So if you see someone committing the offence, call the police first.
Yep.
See if you're able to identify them to 000 or to the operator, whoever on the other end. Ask them if it's okay to make a citizen's arrest. You've got to just bear in mind that the force
sometimes
has to be...
happens pretty quick, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Particularly if someone's walking around with a knife, as has happened in a few other cases.
Yeah, so the force to restrain them, if it's, say, for example, it's like self-defense. You've got to have a minimal approach to get the desired effect. So it's minimum force. So if you, say, for example, just restrain them to the ground, but you're using minimal force, then that would be considered okay. There are instances where police have asked people to come and make a citizen's arrest and assist them just by holding the person to the ground.
So that's all okay?
That's all okay as long as it's reasonable. The the court would decide, well, what would a reasonable person have done? That's why the tip is always, well, contact the police, because they've got further powers
than a citizen. Take a quick break. And sorry, Grant.
Police do have special powers that normal citizens don't. So if you see someone jaywalking, Alan, you shouldn't just tackle them.
You shouldn't go and tackle them to the ground. Brent, you want to tell us a bit about spring. It's a beautiful spring day out there.
It is. And driving up here, I saw somebody, getting ready to paint their fence again. It just looked like everybody's in the right season.
There. Makes you want to do something, doesn't it?
Well, it makes me want to sit down and watch those people do that hard work. It
doesn't make you want to do it.
Well, I think it could be an invasion of their rights for me to start painting their fence. It would just be a little bit wrong. But the one Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "The earth laughs in flowers," and so we're just moving into that season of spring. And another thought is that the seasons are what a symphony ought to be. Four perfect movements in harmony with each other. And that's
that's something about nature, isn't it? It is always in perfect harmony.
But talking about spring, do you know how long we've had the phrase spring cleaning? What year do you think that phrase first came about?
I don't know. I would say early 1900s.
Yeah, 1857. Not too bad. So 1857, and I still haven't caught on.
So how did it come into being?
Well, that goes beyond my script.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell us that.
No, I think obviously somebody in England thought it was and tried to get it as a movement. But the whole idea is getting ready for summer and just clean off those things, the old chairs, and get them ready to put them out in the sun and enjoy the beautiful spring.
Now you've jogged my memory there now, because isn't one of the nationalities where they paint their house every spring? I remember
a very hardworking little nationality there. I imagine that'd be somewhere in probably the Germans. They're pretty hardworking.
No, Austrians. It wasn't. Like, it was in
Poland.
No, it was in one of the other countries, like
the Baltic states.
No.
I'm not really helping you, am I?
No, you're not.
What about Morocco?
No.
Well, it must be somewhere where they've got...
No, none of those, Grant. I'm just not too sure. But she told me they painted their house inside every spring.
Well, I commend them for it, because I think that's a tremendous... They were probably ahead of
when the 1857 spring cleaning.
Well, the last time I had it painted, let's say. Anyway, I did once use a paintbrush. My wife said to me, I'm going to paint this in the middle of summer, the kids' bedroom. And I said, "Darling, it's the wrong time of year. If you do it, I'm not going to be helping." And so she started, and then she took the kids to the beach and left me the room to finish. So, tell you what, it's great to be married. It's great to be married. Now, but the other thing I wanted to let you know is that, do you know, 19% of Australians suffer from hay fever. Isn't that tragic?
But I would have thought, from what we've heard, that it would have been 50 to 60%.
Well, that's the amount of complaining they do. Anyway, let's not go there. And what day is the spring equinox? Come on, it's sometime in September.
Spring, in September.
Give me a day.
15th?
Getting close, come on.
21st.
Higher.
Higher than the 21st or higher than
15th? Yeah, higher than 21st.
Well, 23rd?
Spot on. And there's an actual exact time in Melbourne. I think it's 5 something or other. So if you want to go and...
AM or PM?
That'd be PM, wouldn't it?
I don't know.
Anyway, look, it's worth looking out. Worth looking out for it.
This is Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to Community Connections, and I've got Grant and Illyria with me. Tell me, Illyria, how long have you been with Grant?
I think I've been with him for about a month.
About a month. Oh, gee.
Yeah.
You really throw the newbies in here, Grant, don't you?
Yeah, we like them because you always break them in for us. You
reckon that if they can make it here, they're going to last forever?
They can make it anywhere. It's like New York.
Well, Larry, just tell us, I mean, you've obviously been involved with criminal law before you came with Grant. Where were you practicing? What area?
I was practicing in Frankston, so I was
plenty of work down there.
There is plenty of work down there.
So tell us one of your funnier cases that you came across down there, please.
Well, I had a matter where a person who the police have established that the charges can be proven if the matter was contested wouldn't plead guilty, and
so there was enough plenty of evidence against the person.
There's enough evidence. Yeah. the evidence was a little bit inappropriate, but in the end, after speaking with this person, they decided that they'll accept the responsibility, and we had a magistrate in court on the day where everyone adjourns, so no one would really ever plead someone up in front of him, because this magistrate either took your license, jailed you, or both. So
what, they just got them all put off, deferred?
Every defence lawyer was put off from this magistrate. And this magistrate knew, so sometimes he would actually ask the gallery who's here to adjourn and kick them out to go and adjourn it at the counter so he didn't have to deal with them. A bit of a rogue magistrate we have. So I said to this person, this guy's a wild card. You're either going to get something good or you're going to appeal. So let's just go and do it today because I've been waiting for many months to finalise this matter. And the magistrate heard the plea. He was a little bit surprised, taken aback. I actually was looking at him in the time. He waited for about 2 minutes until he spoke to me because he expected an adjournment. And I said, no, we're going to actually do this.
Okay.
And I indicated, because there wasn't too much harm, it was a breach of a court order and there were multiple breaches in the past, so I said to this person, look, you're looking at a fine or a corrections order, let's just see where we're going with this. And I suggested to the magistrate, well, what about a significant fine? And the magistrate's like, oh, I thought an insignificant fine. And I said, well,
so
of course, I'm in your
more
hands. And the funny thing is that I just kept talking, but then I stopped when he said insignificant, and then he just trailed off on a monologue, and he was thinking, oh, well. I said, well, there's a history of this. He's like, and what kind of history was it? I'm like, oh, well, the person's actually here, the one that was involved in the previous incident. He's like, oh, well, everyone's calling the police these days on people. Nah, you know what? There's no penalty. I'm just going to prove and dismiss. And I'm like, great, take it and leave. I didn't even say anything.
Grant, you want to talk about gun ownership. It's a hot topic in a lot of countries at the moment, isn't it?
Absolutely, if you're in America and what's happening, the tragic news. But
One of the things that would surprise people is that gun ownership now is higher than it was before 1996.
You're talking Australia now.
Australia-wide. So yeah. Particularly in more recent years, the gun ownership rate has been going up and up because people are but they're not doing the semi-automatic or the automatic, so they're doing single shot more. It's just interesting to know that gun ownership is up.
It's higher now than when Port Arthur.
Absolutely. So it's but the death rate by guns has been going down since the 1970s. So it's been going so even before Port Arthur. Then of course there was that blip with Port Arthur.
Yep.
35 people. Remember, that's a huge number. But then in terms of the gun ownership going up again, so again, people, it's just worth noting. It's unusual.
Because the population's gone up though too, hasn't it?
Yeah, but I think under the leadership of, I think John Howard, that was a real test of his leadership.
Yep.
And I think it's less about taking guns away so much as there's a philosophy in Australia that's just so unacceptable. That shocked us as a nation, what happened in 1996.
Whereas in America, It just doesn't shock them, do they? They just keep going.
Well, I think they've been shocked, but then they don't have clear political leadership that says this is just not Australian or this is not American.
Okay.
And so I think they have it's almost like a copycat. It encourages the next person to go, but it so shocked us as a nation that we, and it wasn't politically popular necessarily at the time. I think looking back, people realised that showed real courage of conviction and leadership. But it also said we as a nation, when the Prime Minister flew to Tasmania to stand there at the funerals with others, yep. it kind of expressed for all of us how we felt, that this was just not going to be how we as a culture are going to be perceived. And so while things have happened that have been tragic, it's not with, you know, now we see cars and other things being used, mm. or knives.
And they say that Tim Fisher played a very big part in that as well, because, you know, the country people didn't want to hand over their guns, and Tim Fisher stood very strong with John Howard on that.
He did, and yes, a great man that we recognised passed away in the last month. So yes, it's one of those things which I would say, you're right, as also John Howard with Tim Fisher, I don't know that they necessarily all worked together, but they went to the great areas of greatest opposition. It wasn't just that we would talk to the city yep. crowds,
yep.
but I think it showed. And you're just not seeing that type of political leadership in a country like America. They're not prepared to do that.
Well, the gun lobby is very strong over there too, isn't it? I mean, they pour millions and millions into the re-election campaigns too, to some of the candidates.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm. So what we have in terms of what's, you know, really impacting our society, of course, is gambling, alcohol and all sorts of other things. But in terms of guns and drugs, yeah, illicit drugs. Mm. But in terms of gun ownership, while it's up, we haven't seen it in terms of increased deaths by guns.
That's true.
It only takes one madman.
One nutter.
Anyway, but it's just worth noting.
Larry, you do quite a bit in criminal law, and family violence is really on the up and up, and it's a tragic that it is, and it shouldn't, and all those sorts of things. But what we... So there is family violence involved tonight. The lady, and it's usually the lady, it's not always. So we must admit that sometimes the guys get beat up. How do they then go about getting an intervention order?
Well, usually if there's any sort of physical assault, it is advisable that they first contact police, because police may actually take out or make an application at the court on their behalf. In order to have an intervention order put in place,
the police can do it.
Yes, in other instances where police are unable to do so, they can always go to the court and make an application themselves. The application usually involves making an appointment with the court, filling out a form, and then swearing an oath. Or affirmation that the information is true and correct.
All right, so let's just go back a step, because we want to make this as clear as we possibly can. So there's violence tonight. The police have done what they're going to do, but you're not sure. So you want to take your own intervention. So you're talking about going to court. So but the courts only sit on certain days. So is there a registrar there? I mean, how do they actually go about it physically?
Well, you can make an application online now. So if you go on the Magistrates Court website, Family Ooh. Violence, you can make an application online. There's a form there.
So where would they find that?
So it's actually on the Magistrates Court website.
Do you know the website where they would go for that?
So you can just type in www.magistratescourt. I think it's like .vic.gov. No one quote me on this.
Most of them do have .vic.gov.
Yeah. And, or you can just Google. Straight away, just the keywords, family violence application, Magistrates Court of Victoria, and it takes you straight there.
Right, and so they can fill that that overnight. So say that, well, I'm just trying to make it step by step that the person understands it. So they fill that out tonight. So will the magistrate see that the next morning?
Well, the thing is that you also need to make an appointment with a registrar, because the registrar needs to go through the application with the person. If the only time the magistrate will obviously hear the application, but they have to determine whether there's imminent risk. So if there is imminent risk, then they'll grant something called an interim order. Usually it could be a limited interim order or a full interim order. That interim order goes in place. But if the person is unrepresented, the magistrate may wish to hear from them. So they may actually, and it's up to the magistrate usually, they'll put them in the witness box, or they'll hear evidence from the bar table as to why an interim order should be granted to protect this person from the other person. So it's really, every court has their own specific practice as to how these go, but usually it's the make an appointment, fill out an application, go to the registrar, the registrar will talk you through it, and then you can go before a magistrate.
So in those courts, like I know that sometimes they only sit twice a week or three times a week, but is the registrar there sort of 5 days a week?
They're there every day. Metropolitan courts or suburban courts now actually are 5 days a week operating.
Are they?
So you can make an application at any point. Say, for example, at the Ringwood Court, it's every day. Yep. At the Frankston Court, you've got your days where you have a police application day, so that's like a Monday and a Wednesday, and a citizen's application day is on a Tuesday and Thursday. But they can probably, it depends on the registrar and when they have an appointment, they may be able to fit in applications here and there. But each court has their own system, and it's not necessarily that it's twice a week. Because family violence is becoming so prevalent in the community, the systems have to accommodate it, and therefore they'd probably be increasing the number of days that they'll hear it.
And sometimes you can't wait 3 or 4 days, can you?
Well, that's when the police actually are involved. So if it's really imminent, usually there's police involvement, and usually they're the ones who are making the application. Sometimes the magistrate hearing the application decides that it's more appropriate if police actually file for the application or take over the application and investigate the allegations that have been made.
Fair enough. Grant, you're going to talk about the age of criminal responsibility.
Yes, look, it's interesting that Victorian states and territories
have a common age, which is 10 being the age. Below that, anyone has what would be referred to as the defence of infancy, which is normally that they don't have they're not capable of committing a criminal act. So remember, in a crime, you need both the actus reus and the mens rea, which is a mind that intends to commit a crime and carrying out the act. So a young person might carry out the act, but they may not have known that what they were doing was a crime, or anyway, under 10. So between 10 and 14, I'm going to let Ilaria tell us about what happens there.
Yeah. Well, between 10 and 14, prosecution need to actually prove that the child knew what they were doing was wrong. So
they're going to get up in court and say, no, I didn't know.
Well, it's not basically, the prosecution would have to rely on previous acts, whether there are previous behaviours that would indicate this. They would actually have to draw an argument that they, even if the child thinks what they did wasn't wrong, they knew it was wrong. It's a difficult argument to make if, given these days, children are quite smarter than what they used to be. Mm. They would know that there are certain actions that are wrong from an early age. They usually say that a child develops a personality by the age of 7. So if by the age of 7 a child would know what is right and what is wrong, then obviously if they, for example, committed a theft, they would know that stealing is wrong. So it's hard to argue, especially if there are previous incidents of the same.
All right, look, that's terrific. Now, I've had a request this morning. I'm just going to touch on this. I'm just not sure how we're going to handle this, but for you to bring back next week, and I'm sure part of it you're going to say you know straight away. But the chances are, hang on, we'll just get a bit of paper for you to write on.
So we can take a note. Yes, go for it, Alan.
Righto. So I believe, or the person who rang me said that last night this... the Act went through, I think, State Parliament about the priest. Now, I don't want to get into a religious argument. That's the last thing I want to take on, that they now have to tell what's in the... told them in the confessional. Right? So the first thing is, the person wants to know, is that only relating to pedophilia? Because that's really what started this case on. Does it include such things as rape and murder? Does a priest now have to anything that's told them in the confessional, that they can be under risk of jail if they don't do it? And the person also, and you'll love this, wants to know then where that puts the legal profession. Now, your job as a legal eagle is, I don't want to put myself in it, but if somebody comes to you and says, I've been charged with rape, I've been charged with pedophilia, I've been charged with murder, your job is to either put doubt into the jury or to put doubt in the mind of the judge, or to call into doubt the evidence. That's fine. But if that person walked in and said to you, hey, I've been charged with rape and I did it, where do you stand? Or if they walk in and said, I've been charged with pedophilia, rape or murder, where do you stand? Do you have a duty to then say to the courts, well, I don't know how you can, because how can you put somebody, you know, try to argue that they didn't do it if you already know they've been told? So, A, do you not want to know? So, could you come back with that on us?
Absolutely.
I know it sounds fairly easy, but it's not. It's a fairly complex sort of thing, I would have thought.
It is, and particularly around, so looking at the Act is important to see whether there are any amendments. I think you may find it's only gone through the Legislative Assembly, not the Legislative Council, or it might be that it's gone through both.
The person thought it had gone through both.
I guess the point isn't
whether what that does. We're supposing that it is going to come into law, so what does a priest have to tell about whether it's just pedophilia? Because I think that's what it was originally about. But it's whether
it's been reported in terms of abuse of children, yep. So that could be a lot broader than just.
Well, let's
look at the Act.
No, well, let's even take it a bit further than that.
Yes.
You're talking about children. Supposing somebody came in and said they'd committed one of those other two against an adult, does the priest then still have to tell it?
Well, let's come back and keep the listeners on the edge of their seats,
yep.
as we wait to hear. We're moving into a new area of law in terms,
yep.
of, so always what was said in the confessional was always protected.
Yep.
The philosophy behind that being that, anyway, is there a place where somebody can go and hopefully work with a priest to stop doing it?
Yep.
But is that, anyway, look, I don't, let's not examine the merits of it or otherwise, but let's look at the law and let's come back to you. And where does it leave a lawyer? So I think it sounds like Ilaria will be coming back next month.
All right. Well, unfortunately, it's time for the 1 o'clock news.
Fantastic.
Thanks for the two of you coming along. We always enjoy this segment. And part of the segment, as we've always said, is to try and educate the public as to what the actual rights and wrongs of the law are. So thanks for coming.